Does anyone have any questions from discussion group they'd like to bring up?
If we need to be aware when we reflect on death, but creating karma, like if we're reflecting, we're going to get cancer or something like that?
I'm not sure what you mean. So you're doing a death reflection and then?
You said that when you start to think about something, you create a karma. So if I'm thinking I'm going to have cancer...
No. But of course, if we... I mean, in the death reflection, it's not about thinking in this way. It's about reflecting on the fact of those points that we talked about this morning, you know, the fact that, you know, we may not live forever, there are many causes for death, so forth and so forth. Of course, if we sort of get obsessed about getting some sort of illness or something, then of course that's going to make us feel bad, and it won't really, and that's why it will. What we'll do is that we're sort of, often people worry about things, and that doesn't mean that they're going to happen, but what it means is that we are not going to be working, moving in a positive direction because we're focusing on the negative. So, therefore, in this death reflection, it's not about worrying about, you know, will I get cancer or something like that. I think that's not a healthy way of doing this death reflection. So, therefore, just to reflect on these points sort of in the way that we mentioned, and generally, of course, also many people tend to worry or have anxiety about possible things happening in the future. And statistics show that 95% of the things we worry about never eventuate anyway. And so, of course, worrying about things like that doesn't help anything. It just makes us feel anxious. So we're not talking about worrying about something in the future, because then we're living in the future. We're sort of jumping into the future. Whereas this reflection is about reflecting on death so that in the moment we can take advantage of the opportunity we have now and not worry about what may or may not happen in the future. So that's not really going to be very helpful, doing it like that.
In the meditation we tried, it was really beneficial to imagine that, like, we have cancer and we have 5 months.
Exactly. And so that was a hypothetical situation of to really understand from that meditation that we only appreciate things when we've lost it or about to lose it. And so by going through that exercise, then now we can really appreciate the preciousness of the life we have now. So this is like a sort of a hypothetical situation in that way. But sort of in the moment now, worrying about what may or may not happen in the future is not going to be helpful. So I think that's a little bit different than sitting here worrying about what may or may not happen. This is just going through that process to appreciate the fact of the preciousness of our life. So I think that can be helpful.
No? I don't know. Because some people didn't do it because they're afraid of... also in our religion, we have... If you think about something, it might happen. So it was just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, what we often do in our modern society is, regarding death, we not only don't think about it, we actively avoid it. And all that does is it makes death an unknown phenomenon. And often, because of that, people develop a lot of fear and anxiety about it. And that's not helpful. So if we can reflect on it in a healthy way, not in an unhealthy way about worrying about all sorts of things, but reflect on it in a healthy way as we've done, then We can understand death more clearly and thereby understand the preciousness of our life and take advantage of our life. So the idea is not to sit and sort of become depressed about death. The idea is to reflect on it and then really, again, the positive opposite, then reflect on the preciousness of our life. And that then we can focus on. That would be better.
Again, the difference between emptiness and impermanence.
That's the question? Ah. If we really appreciate impermanence, then it's almost realizing emptiness. There's no guarantee that by realizing impermanence we'll realize emptiness, because I think we can, you know, we can have a sort of a vague realization of emptiness with this understanding, because that's better than what we've got now. But if we have a sort of a taste or understanding of emptiness like this, of course, this is not emptiness. But if we are very intuitive, we may have this sort of understanding or experience, then we're very close to realizing emptiness. And the lower Buddhist philosophical systems, in fact, sort of have this understanding of impermanence. And so for them, things are impermanent and they're not empty, and there's no contradiction. Whereas what we're saying, actually, if we really appreciate impermanence and not understand the empty, that's contradictory.
You mentioned that today there's a lot of, like, this sort of trend of mindfulness, and I was wondering if you could maybe clarify the differences between the modern day mindfulness and the Buddhist mindfulness.
That's coming in out of this afternoon's topic, because I'm going to talk about shamatha practice, and of course the main tool there is mindfulness, so I'll answer that question this afternoon.
What's the difference between memories and imprints?
Memories and imprints.
So in the flow of change, right, everything's moving.
Right.
But the consciousness can access memories that have happened, so
sure,
they've gone.
Right.
Is that an imprint, or is it?
Yeah, you can. I mean, again, remember, imprint is a concept that is used to understand certain processes, particularly in terms of karma. That concept of imprint is often used to understand how action leads to experience. But not all Buddhist philosophical systems use the concept of imprint when they explain karma. There are other concepts that are used, which I won't go into now. And again, we can have the idea of memory being imprint, and some philosophical systems use that, and others do not in explaining memory. So again, it can be helpful to explain how memory works. We can use that concept. Sure.
So I'm sure lots of people here already have a lot of experience fasting, but for those who
don't have or do. I do have.
But for those of us who are a bit less strong-willed, do you have any words of inspiration?
Inspiration, okay. I can mention a couple of things. One, of course, and I assume you're referring to what I was talking about, these eight precepts. One is to just run the experiment and see how much craving we actually do have for food. So just to realize the extent of our craving and attachment. So that's already beneficial, just to come to see how much cravings we actually have. And another thing is that, particularly if we're doing a meditation retreat, at least some sort of restriction of amount of food we eat is very helpful for concentration. Very helpful. Like when I do retreat, I never really have more than two meals. I have a little bit of breakfast and lunch and then nothing in the afternoon or evening. And your mind gets very sharp. In fact, there's one practice in Tibetan Buddhism called Chu Len, taking the essence. And it involves these sort of little pills, basically mineral pills. And you can do this over various time, but usually as a beginning point, and it's a guided retreat, so someone guides you, you don't have to do it yourself. Over the first couple of days, you reduce your food intake to nil, and then for a couple, 3 or 4 days, you just take these pills, and then at the end, you start eating again. You know, so you usually do a week or 10 days starting point. I've never had the opportunity to do one, but I know a few friends who did, and they were amazed at how sharp and clear their mind was when they were fasting. They've said they've never been that clear-minded. So this can also be very good. So if you're going to do this, then you may look at the sharpness of your mind as a result. But I think the main thing that can be interesting is just see how much craving we actually do have for food. Could be interesting. So Mahayana, of course, is the level of practice where we are striving for enlightenment for the benefit of others. And in Mahayana level of practice, the traditions that follow this, of course, are Zen, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese and Tibetan. So all of these are Mahayana. Within Tibetan Buddhism, there are 4 schools and each have a system of practice for Mahayana. And what we looked at this morning was Lam Rim. Another one in the Kagyu tradition is Mahamudra. Mahamudra. Kagyu. The Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. And the Mahamudra, their particular emphasis in the way they package is they really focus on the mind. And they often, Mahamudra is called nature of the mind practice, because it's very much focused on the mind and the nature of the mind, as is Dzogchen from the Nyingma school. Both of those are very similar in the way they, their perspective and the way they package things. So what you find is that going directly into the sutras, you find that more common in the Theravada schools, where in the Mahayana, generally they would refer to one of the great Indian masters' commentaries. And of course in the commentaries they quote various sutras, but it's not that common in particularly certain Tibetan Buddhism that you would directly work with. There are some sutras that, of course, are very popular, and like Heart Sutra and Golden Light Sutra and Diamond Cutter Sutra. And there are some sutras that are also directly used in the Mahayana, but not so common. Rather, we tend to use the Indian commentaries, which sort of collect a common theme amongst various sutras and package it in a very sort of clear way. So there's not really sort of a book of sutras. I mean, of course, in the original Sanskrit and Tibetan, I mean, all of this, some of it is just sutras and some are Indian commentaries and Tibetan commentaries. But in English, in the Mahayana, there's probably not a lot of books directly on sutras. You probably will find some, but not so common. Okay, let's move on to this afternoon's topic. So this afternoon, I want to again focus on the concentration practice, the shamatha practice. We saw that in all Buddhist traditions, 3 core practices, ethics, concentration, wisdom. So we've looked at ethics in terms particularly of the 10 virtues, and the wisdom we've looked at in terms of these 3 marks of existence and the idea of emptiness. So what I'd like to do now is look a bit more detail about the concentration practice. And the word concentration in Sanskrit is samadhi. And what we need to be aware of is this word samadhi in other systems is used and interpreted a little bit differently. I think in some systems samadhi is the goal of the path, whereas here samadhi simply means concentration. And we can develop many levels of concentration. And the level of concentration that we talk about in Mahayana is shamatha. In the Theravada traditions, when they talk about samadhi or concentration practice, you won't often hear so much about shamatha. You'll hear about dhyana. And there are actually four levels of dhyana. So we can talk about the four dhyanas.
I'm confused. Is shamatha concentration or it's a level of concentration?
A level of concentration.
A specific level?
Specific level.
That you're aspiring to?
Exactly. Exactly. There are many levels of concentration. The minimum level that we require as a basis for Vipassana practice, if we want a direct realization of emptiness, is shamatha. Higher levels of concentration include the four dhyanas. Then there are four levels higher than that. Which in Sanskrit are called samapati. Sometimes translated in English as absorptions. And at the time of the Buddha, some traditions at the time of the Buddha felt this was the way to liberation, to nirvana. That all we have to do is keep developing higher levels of concentration and eventually we'd be liberated. And what the Buddha discovered was that no matter how high a level of concentration we develop, we will never be liberated, because concentration doesn't eliminate mental afflictions, it just subdues, it keeps the lid on them. We need to add wisdom to this if we want to overcome mental afflictions. So, therefore, in the Mahayana, we've talked a lot about developing, cultivating a level of concentration called shamatha. And so that's what I'd like to focus on now.
And samadhi is the same as shamatha. It's interchangeable. Samadhi.
No, samadhi is a general term, generic term meaning concentration. We can have many levels of samadhi. One of those levels is shamatha. So shamatha is a particular level of samadhi. It's the one that we talk about mainly in the Mahayana. And so that's what I'd like to talk about this afternoon. So, why do we need to do this shamatha practice? Of course, from a Buddhist perspective, it's the basis of all other practices, particularly Vipassana. And we can know this from our own experience. If we try to do any sort of meditation and our mind is not focused, if we're distracted and dull, they won't have any effect. Vipassana, compassion, whatever the meditation is, if we're not focused, they're not really going to have any effect on us. So shamatha is the basis of all of these analytical meditations, compassion, vipassana, all of these meditations. And particularly if we want to, again, have a direct realization of emptiness, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. But also, shamatha practice has direct positive impact in our life as well, of course. Because by improving, if cultivating shamatha, we're developing a more calm, more clear, more focused mind, which means in daily life we'll be much more effective in everything we do, much less agitation and stress, much less mental imbalance, and we're going to start to enjoy the simple pleasures in life more than we do now. And we are going to become the masters of our mind instead of the slaves of our mind. Instead of being tormented by our mind, we'll become the masters of our mind. So there's a lot of short-term and long-term benefit to doing this shamatha practice. So let's look at how we train in it, the practice. And I want to look at a few elements of practice. Some of these we've already talked about in the first evening, but I think it's good to repeat them again. We'll look at what qualities we need to develop or cultivate in this practice. What object should we use? What are the main tools we use in this practice? And what sort of faults are there in this practice, and how do we overcome these faults? And then we're going to look at the end, the stages of progress. How do we know we're progressing, and what sort of stages do we go through of progress in this practice? So the qualities, and we looked at this on the first evening. So remember here, we're trying to develop a calm, clear, focused mind. So one quality we're trying to cultivate, of course, is stability, to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted. So the fault we're trying to overcome here is distraction. But not only do we want a stable mind, we want to be able to focus on the object in a very clear way. So the second quality is clarity. So of course there, the fault we're trying to overcome is dullness. But I added a third quality that's normally not talked about in the text, in the meditation text, and that is relaxation. And the fault there is tension, tightness. As a beginner in meditation, I think this is the main reason we have difficulties in meditation. We're simply too tight, too tense, we're trying too hard. Because many of us in our modern society, of course, lead very hectic, fast-paced lives, bombarded by stimulus, minds get agitated, very tense. This is our normal way of operating in daily life. And then, of course, because our minds are so chaotic, when we want to focus on an object or task, we tense. Because if we don't, we just get distracted. And if we do that for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we focus with tension for a longer time, we become completely exhausted and often become very agitated. So we don't want to do this here. The first thing we really need to learn to do is relax. And to really highlight the importance of this, I'd like to read a little bit from Alan Wallace again. And here he's talking about the practice of focusing on the breath in the shamatha practice. Thus, our practice of mindfulness of breathing consists of prolonging our awareness of our breath. While this requires an alert mind, such concentration should not be tense, but rather balanced. When we discover that we have become distracted from the meditation object, it may feel natural to clamp down more forcefully, tightly concentrating the mind. You see this in the facial expressions of people who try to concentrate in this way. Their lips become pursed, their eyebrows draw together, and their foreheads become furled with wrinkles. They're becoming concentrated, but like orange juice, most of the fluidity is being drained from their minds. If you want to concentrate for a short time and don't mind the side effects of tension and fatigue, you can follow the above strategy. But if you want to follow the path of shamatha, you'll need an alternative. I had to discover this fact through experience. During my first extended shamatha retreat, I was filled with enthusiasm. I wanted to take full advantage of the rare opportunity that was before me, for I was meditating in India under the guidance of the Dalai Lama. In fact, he was in one of these little meditation retreat huts just above Dharamkot. Just on the little hill behind Dharamkot, you can see four or five meditation huts. That's where he was meditating. I had no financial worries, and my material needs were easily met. All I had to do was to put the instructions into practice. I threw myself into this training with all my might. Each morning I would rise at 3:30. Except once I slept in until 3:45 and got upset with myself for slacking off. Enthusiastic I was, but so uptight. The Tibetan manuals on shamatha meditation that I had studied over the years stated that the type of attention needed when one began such practice was, quote, highly focused. So I tried as hard as I could to keep my mind from wandering. Within a matter of a few weeks, devoting many hours each day to meditation, I could sustain my attention on my chosen object for up to half an hour. I was elated by making such fast progress. As the weeks went by, however, I found myself becoming more and more fatigued. I was draining myself both physically and mentally. My joy in the practice was diminishing accordingly, and I felt my attention was not developing any further. What was wrong? I was trying too hard. The cultivation of shamatha involves balancing the mind, and that includes balancing the effort exerted in the practice with relaxation. I think this points to a cultural difference between traditional Tibetans living in the highlands of Tibet and modern people leading fast-paced lives. Their senses constantly bombarded by telephones, email, the media, and noise. Years of such existence condition the nervous system and mind in ways that might have been considered torture in rural Tibet. One traditional Tibetan doctor whom I know once commented on people living in the West. So now he's quoting the Tibetan doctor who says, "From the perspective of Tibetan medicine, you are all suffering from nervous disorders. But given how ill you are coping remarkably well." Whether we dwell in Boston, Buenos Aires, Berlin, or Beijing, our minds are conditioned to be more high-strung and engaged in compulsive thinking than the minds of Tibetan nomads and farmers living a century ago. So when the Tibetan meditation manuals advise beginners to focus their attention firmly, the instructions are aimed at a very different reader than the average city dweller in the 21st century. Before we can develop attentional stability, we first need to learn to relax. So I think that's some very good advice. And I know from personal experience, if you don't relax, you're going to have all sorts of problems. As he said, if you have tension, maybe initially you make progress, but it comes at a high cost. And particularly if you go into retreat with this tension, you're going to have all sorts of problems. You're going to have a lot of agitation, fatigue, maybe even get headaches from meditating. So we really don't want to go that way. So we really need to relax, relax, relax. And it's only on the basis of a relaxed body and mind that we'll be able to develop stability and clarity. So we really need to develop in this order. So that's something very important. Object. What object to use? As I mentioned on the first evening, the recommendation is use the object that works best for you. There are many possibilities. What we're doing in this course is we are using three objects. The breath, and that's probably the most widely emphasized object in Buddhism. And the meditation texts often say, if you're the sort of person who's highly discursive, meaning always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. And so I think most of us in the modern society are a bit obsessive compulsive thinkers, thinking all the time. By focusing on the breath, of course, it gets us out of our conceptual mind into the body. So that's a good start. And most of our conceptual thinking is about the past and the future. The sensations of the breath only happen in the present moment. So by focusing on them, it gets us out of our conceptual mind into the body and out of the past and the future into the present moment. So probably for many of us, the breath is going to be the best object for shamatha practice. Question?
Yes, I'm a bit confused, but I'm relaxed in a way. You said for people who have OCD thinking, the best one is like focus on the breath. But before you said it was focus on the mind, and focus on the mind, and the third one was to just relax in the
awareness. Okay, I'm
so
coming.
All of them are the best.
No.
For people with OCD thinking,
I'll clarify now. One other object we're using in this course is focusing on the mind. And it's true that this can be very helpful for people who are a bit of OCD thinking. The reality is, if we're that sort of person, it's very difficult to even begin this practice because we have such a strong habit of getting caught up in our thoughts. So often, even though there's a lot of benefit for this, for OCD, what people often find is that they can't even begin to do this because there's such a strong habit of following. So what's a good procedure is start here. Work with this for some weeks, months, or even years. Allow the mind to settle down a bit. Be more calm, more clear, more focused. Then we can switch to this practice. And then we can really gain a lot of benefit. Some people find that from the very beginning, they can work with this practice. Then we do that. And it could be better than using this practice. So again, we have to look at ourselves and see which one works best for us. Similarly, the third one that we're using in this course is no object, or this awareness of awareness. And again, I think for many of us in our modern society, there are a lot of benefit with this practice. But it's more subtle, and many people find it very difficult to get into this practice. But some people really are very strongly drawn to it, and find actually that works best for them. So again, it depends on us as an individual. And I think all of these three can be, if we can get into them, can be very helpful for this OCD type of mind.
What is OCD?
Obsessive compulsive, well, delusional disorder, but basically obsessive compulsive thinking. And the huge majority of us in our modern society are sort of pretty, a little bit obsessive compulsive thinking, just all the time, myself included.
To continue that question, what would be the measure of best for me? How can I tell?
Right.
What is best for me? And are they a progression of levels, these three, or?
They're not a progression of levels, but we can use those stages. And that's one of the things that sometimes Alan Wallace recommends. As we're going to look at shortly, we can go through 9 stages in the practice. And one of his recommendations is start here, move up a couple of levels, then we can switch here, move a few more levels, and then switch here. But we don't have to do that. We can start here and use that the whole way. We can start here and go the whole way. Doesn't have to. A measure of what's best for us, part of that is not just what is easiest for us now. Because maybe this is easiest, but we're not interested in it. We get bored by it. Then it's not going to work. So part of what's best for us is, are we enthusiastic about using this object? Part of the understanding. Because again, in general, most people as a beginner find this easiest, but of course also some people find this not so interesting and they get a little bit bored with it. And of course if we get bored with it, we're not going to go anywhere. We're just going to go into dullness and distraction. So therefore, even if this is a little bit, one of these is a little bit more difficult, but we're really strongly drawn to it and we're really enthusiastic, then maybe this is the better choice for us. Because if we can be enthusiastic, even if it's a bit difficult, we'll be able to make progress.
But there's no, one is not considered more advanced or more beneficial or more anything than the others. Like, they're all equally good.
Again, it depends on us as an individual whether it's good or not. And of course, what you find in Tibetan Buddhism, because in all the schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the highest form of practice is Vajrayana or Tantra. And in that level of practice, of course, we are, as I said, we are arising in the fully enlightened form. So therefore, sometimes you find in Tibetan Buddhism, when it comes to shamatha practice, they talk about, as an object, visualize an image of a Buddha. But many people find that very difficult because many of us are not very good at visualizing, and a Buddha is not something very familiar to us. So many of us in the modern society find that very difficult. But some people who are very visual, maybe like, you know, designers or architects or something, maybe actually that's the best, you know, to have some visual image, to use that as the object. So we're not saying you have to use one of those, but we've introduced them in this course because I think each one of those can bring enormous benefit in our modern society. But again, we use, and sometimes in the text, it says, oh, you can't even focus on the breath, that's too difficult. Okay, then pick a stick or a pebble, a little object, put it down and look at it. So we can use that as a beginning point. But this is a very coarse object because it's visual. It may help in the beginning stages, but then eventually we'll need to move on to something a little bit more subtle than just looking at an object. But for some of us, that could be the best starting point. Just look at something and use that. The text also mentioned that.
Can you give me more examples or disadvantages, advantages of, or on more objects, like sound, visuals, or...
Yeah. So again, visual is a little bit limited. It could be useful in the beginning stages. Again,
I mean visual with eyes closed.
Well, that's a mental image.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that's more mind.
Yeah. Mental object is better. Yeah. The thing with any sort of sense object is what we find is that as we progress in this practice and our focus becomes better, what we find actually is our sense faculties begin to go dormant. And at the high levels of this practice, the sense faculties shut down. So if you're using a sense object, you lose the object, meaning a visual object, a sound, and so forth, because you're not, your sense faculties shut down. So a sense object is a little bit limited, but in the beginning phase, it could be the best. But you'll need to go beyond that to a mental object. But you say, well, hang on, the breath is a sense object, so how can we do that then? The one advantage with the breath is that what you find, if you're using the breath as the object and you progress, at some point, what happens is you get what's called the acquired sign, which is a mental image spontaneously arises. And this acquired sign is a mental image related to the air element. It's not something you generate, it's something that spontaneously arises the deeper we go into the practice, if we're focusing on the breath. So when that mental image appears, and that mental image can look many different ways depending on an individual, they give a list of many different things that appear, like a star, a cobweb, a wreath, all sorts of things. When that mental image spontaneously appears, you shift from the sensations of breath to that mental image, and then you keep going with that.
It's not distracting.
No, you use that as the object. It's a mental image, it's not visual. You use that mental image and you focus on that as the object. Because then slowly the sensations will dissipate because you'll focus. So you switch to that. It was actually the first time many years ago I did a Goenka retreat over here. And then afterwards I met someone and I said I did that. And he said to me, "Did you see the blue light?" Blue light? What are you talking about? I think he was talking about the acquired sign. We're not saying that in this practice, every time you have some mental image appearing, it's the acquired sign. You know, because you are, to get the acquired sign, you already have to be quite well advanced in the practice. You know, it varies when you get this, but typically it would be at a stage where you could focus on the breath, say, for 30 minutes or an hour without distraction. That sort of level we're talking about. Yeah. Again, the heartbeat is a physical sensation. And the problem with sound, of course, is if the sound stops, you've got no object. Yeah. Again, one thing we need to be very much careful with, particularly in our modern society because of the tension, is focusing anywhere along here is a very powerful place of focus. And so sometimes in the text, particularly in Tantra, when they talk about shamatha, they say, focus here, focus here. But generally, I don't recommend it for us in our modern society because of the tension. Because this is a very powerful point in the body. And if you focus here with tension, you can really unbalance subtle energies dramatically. And then you can really get a lot of agitation in the mind. So, yes, you can focus. And often they talk about, you know, a little white light here, use that as the focus, or a little image of a Buddha or something here. But again, if you're going to do that, I would recommend to be very cautious, to be super relaxed. Because if you're not, and I know from experience, you're going to have all sorts of problems because of that tension, that tightness. Because that's going to cause a lot of imbalance in subtle energies. And in Tibetan, there's a word called lum, which just means energy, wind energy. But actually they use it to talk about a problem that we get in retreat, a mental imbalance and a subtle energy imbalance called lum. It's a disorder. And it's very common in Western meditators who go into retreat gung-ho and go pushing, I want to achieve something, and then a few weeks or months later they come out with this loom, and they're all messed up physically and mentally, and it really takes, and it's hard to get overcome that. We can be stuck with that for years. So we really don't want to go that way. Again, if we do it with a lot of relaxation, it's okay. But, and that's also, some of you may notice focusing here, you have a lot of sensations across the forehead. Tension. Because this is a subtle object, our tendency can be to tighten, because it's subtle. And then we have a lot of sensations across the forehead. That's a warning sign that we're way too tense. If you have a lot of sensations here, even if you can pick up the sensations clearly, do not keep focusing with that tension. Because if we do that in a retreat setting, hour after day after day, we're going to get this loom, and it's not going to be very helpful. So if we can't release the tension, do not stay here. Go down to the abdomen. Move down and relax. This is very important. And I'm speaking from personal experience. I know all about this. And a number of my colleagues who also, and we have this in our society, this striving, you know, I've got to get somewhere, I've got to make use of my time and push, and then it doesn't work. So that's why I can't overemphasize relaxation, particularly in a retreat setting where we're doing a lot of meditation. So important.
They're on the back, I think, yeah. Is next.
What about the body as an object? Like, to start with the feet, and just to be with the feet and then to go up all over the body?
Yeah, again, in initial phases, that's a little bit what you did, just noticing the sensations of breath anywhere in the body. And so this is good for relaxation. So yes, if we're very agitated and tense, then this can be a good starting point, is just noticing sensations in the body. But what you're going to find is because it's very diffuse and you're moving a lot, it's going to be difficult to really develop these well. But it could be, for some time, good for this. And then we can be more narrow the focus to a smaller area.
I found it like the best method, this one and the breathing.
Yeah, exactly. So again, we really need to work on this. And there are many levels of relaxation. What we'll find is when we're doing this and we're relaxing, at some point we'll go, oh wow, I'm really relaxed now. And if we keep going, we'll go to a whole new level of relaxation. We'll go, wow, I'm really relaxed now. And then we'll more and more. There are many levels of relaxation. The deeper we can go, the better the basis we have for stability and clarity. Yeah. Again, what I would really recommend is if we are really agitated, tense person and we can't relax, sitting upright, lie down. Use the Shavasana, the corpse posture, as your normal meditation posture. But then only associate Shavasana with meditation. Don't use Shavasana just to relax and sort of get drowsy. If you're going to use the Shavasana for meditation, I would recommend you only use Shavasana for meditation. So you associate that posture with meditation. Otherwise, you'll get into that posture and you'll get sleepy. Because often we use it to relax and become quite drowsy. But if we use it only for meditation, then I think we can be super relaxed and very alert at the same time. I use that posture a lot. I really like it.
I'm a bit confused because I was told that I should pick the object that my mind doesn't naturally crave.
Because
I was giving the example that in front of a movie, the first screen in front of me, my mind would happily concentrate on it for like 2 hours. So I should pick an object that my mind doesn't naturally dissolved in it just so I can develop it. Because if I give it away once, I'm not developing it.
Right. I mean, maybe it's a bit difficult to crave the breath because it's a bit ordinary. Of course, craving any sort of object is just going to agitate the mind. So what we really need to pick, again, is an object that works best for us.
Is best easiest?
Not just easiest, but again, we have to have some enthusiasm to work with it. You know, if this is easiest, but we find it boring, and we can't make it interesting, then it's probably not going to work. We're just going to go into dullness and distraction using the breath, because we're not interested in it. So, and of course, if we notice any craving and attachment, and this can definitely come into this practice, because, in fact, I'll bring that in now, there are three qualities of mind that become more and more manifest and obvious the more we go in shamatha practice. The deeper we go into the shamatha practice, the more these qualities will start to manifest. Clarity, meaning our mind becomes very clear. Non-conceptuality here means our mind becomes very still. And bliss, of course, the mind becomes very joyful. The meditation manuals warn the meditator about these experiences because they're so seductive. Each one of these experiences is very pleasant. And so when they start to arise, there's a very much great danger. We go, oh, that's so nice. I want that. I want that. We start craving and grasping it. And of course, as soon as we do, it's gone. And then we try to recreate it with craving and grasping. And of course, it won't come back. And we're going to get very frustrated. I know from personal experience. Again, the Goenka retreat when I did first time many years ago, it wasn't shamatha, but part of the practice was scanning the body. And if you do it well, sometimes you can have this flow of blissful sensations in the body. And I managed to get that, I think, on day 4. I thought, wow, this is so nice. I want this. And of course, as soon as I did that, gone. I spent the next 4 days trying to recreate it, each day getting more and more and more frustrated. Day 8, I had enough. I said, I give up. They came back. And then, of course, craving came back, gone again.
What's the Goenka retreat exactly? You keep mentioning it. I don't know exactly what it is.
I am. Don't worry. We haven't got time to explain it here. But, so, what I want to say here is that when these experiences come in your practice, use them as a signpost that we're heading in the right direction. And don't get caught up with them in craving, because if you do, your whole practice will come to a grinding halt. Rather, use them to go deeper into the practice, rather than craving and grasping them.
Can you just briefly review how the shamatha coincides or crisscrosses with the vipassana? Like, do you do one day shamatha, one day vipassana, or do you do shamatha for a number of months and then vipassana?
That would depend on us as an individual. If we are the sort of person who our attention skills are very poor as a beginner, then there's not much point in engaging in a lot of vipassana practice, because we're going to put a lot of effort and not really get anywhere because our mind is constantly distracted and half asleep. So therefore, if our attention skills are very poor as a beginner, I would recommend emphasize this. Not to the exclusion of compassion and vipassana. That's a little bit unbalanced. But maybe as a beginner, we emphasize this practice and still do occasionally a bit of vipassana, a couple of times a week or whatever. And so then we need a balance, of course, between all these practices. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that on the last morning of the course. But again, to answer your question, it would depend on us as an individual, how that balance, what it looks like. But there needs to be a balance.
And the wisdom practice can be reflecting on those, like the no self, the impermanence,
the suffering. Yes, yes.
Is the object of concentration can be a moving mental image?
It can be. But you'll find that if it's too much movement, you won't be able to get very deep in this. Again, in the beginning point, looking around in the body to relax is fine, so we could use that, but you will find that if there's too much movement in the object, you probably find it's not going to...
Like, stable but moving.
Yeah. Like sometimes people focus on chanting a mantra. In the beginning phase, again, that can help, but I think at some point we'll need to go into an object that is more subtle than the sound of the mantra, if we want to really go deeper at some point. But in the initial stages, it could be helpful to help us to relax and to overcome distraction. Okay. Tools. What? Go on.
Is it time to change object?
Right. Object, so, again, what's not recommended is one day use this, next day something else, next day something else. Keep changing like that is not productive. Having said that, we could start with the breath, use that for some weeks or months or longer. And then when we're a little bit more stable, we could switch to using the mind and then continue with that for some time or switch to this. That's okay. But swapping every day or week backwards and forwards is not going to help us go further. So constant changing is not helpful. Okay. Tools. What tools are we using? The two main tools are mindfulness and introspection. And actually for this, maybe we can use our booklet because I want us to look at this shamatha diagram shortly. So in our booklet on page 24, we see down the bottom the meditator. And in their left hand is a rope, in the right hand is a hook. These are the two tools we use. The rope is symbolizing mindfulness. So mindfulness is our ability to focus on an object without becoming distracted. So the analogy is that we tie our mind with a rope of mindfulness to the object. But then we need quality control. We need to monitor that, to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted. So that's introspection. Introspection is quality control. It's noticing if we're becoming dull or distracted. And so that's symbolized by the hook, meaning to hook the mind back when we notice we're becoming dull or distracted. So that is the two tools we use in this practice. And mindfulness here in Sanskrit is smriti, in Pali, sati. Both of those words literally mean to remember. So mindfulness is remembering the object, being able to hold the object, not forgetting it, not becoming distracted. As I think already briefly mentioned, mindfulness is very popular now in the modern society. What we need to be aware of is the word mindfulness in a number of these modern traditions has been redefined in a different way. And it's often been defined as something like a non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Very good thing to do, but this is not how the word mindfulness was originally used. So we need to be aware of that to avoid any confusion. So here, mindfulness is simply our ability to remember the object, to hold the object without forgetting it, without becoming distracted. And we are, if we look at this chart now, in terms of faults, we can look over onto the opposite page. Up the top it says, shamatha is attained by progressing through the nine stages, which are the nine diagrams here along the windy road, relying on the eight antidotes to abandon the five faults. So we see the table there, the five faults. So, of course, the first fault is laziness. And laziness has four antidotes. The first antidote is faith. Like everything in our life, if we see no benefit in a certain activity, we're going to be very lazy when it comes to doing that activity. Similarly here, in the shamatha practice, if we really see no benefit in it and we're just doing it because someone told us to do it, we're going to be very lazy when it comes to doing the shamatha practice. So to overcome that, we are to reflect on the benefits of this practice. Because in daily life, if we see a lot of benefit in something, we're not going to be very lazy when it comes to doing it. We're going to put a lot of effort into it if we see a lot of benefit. Similarly here, if we reflect on the benefits of this practice, such as that we're going to cultivate a very calm, clear, focused mind, we're going to become the masters of our mind instead of the slaves of our mind, much less agitation and stress, and it's going to be the basis of all other practices. If we reflect on these sorts of benefits, then we'll have the first antidote, faith. We'll have faith that the practice is going to benefit us. And then faith that the practice will benefit us will lead us to the second antidote, aspiration. We'll develop aspiration to do the practice. And then when we have aspiration to do the practice, we'll have the third antidote. We'll put effort into the practice. And then the more effort we put into the practice, the more we will have the fourth antidote, which is pliancy. Pliancy here means flexibility and serviceability of body and mind. Now, both our body and mind are not very flexible or serviceable. We have a lot of aches and pains in our body, and we have a lot of resistance in our mind to the practice. So they're not very flexible. But as we go deeper into the practice, we'll have that more and more happening. Second fault is forgetfulness. So this can be forgetting the instruction or forgetting the object. And of course, the antidote is mindfulness. And then the third fault is laxity and excitement. Laxity is a technical word for dullness, and excitement is the most common form of distraction. We are distracted by the so-called sense pleasures, hence the word excitement. How the antidote to those, of course, is introspection, quality control, noticing when we're becoming dull and distracted. The fourth fault is non-application. What that means is that we've noticed that we've become dull or distracted and we don't do anything about it. That's a problem. So, of course, the antidote is application, which means if we notice we're dull or distracted, fix it. Reapply mindfulness. The fifth fault is over-application. As a beginner, that's often not so much of a problem. Over-application means that actually we're focusing on the object well, and we unnecessarily keep adjusting our focus. That's a problem. If we are actually focusing well on the object and we unnecessarily adjust our focus, that's a problem. So the antidote is equanimity. Here, equanimity means balance. It means that our focus is good already, so don't change it. Leave it in a balanced state. So if it's not broken, don't fix it. So these are the five faults and the eight antidotes. And it says here, by applying the eight antidotes to the five faults, we will move along these nine stages to shamatha. So let's have a brief look at this chart, because there could be some practical advice to help us in our practice.
Just going back, what's the difference between mindfulness and concentration?
Mindfulness is the mental factor that we use that will lead to concentration. Concentration in Buddhism is a state of mind that incorporates other elements as well. Antidote, benefit, it's a bit technical, but concentration includes things like this joy and bliss is part of the concentrated mind. The fact that we are free of certain things is part of concentration. So these are all elements within the concentration. So mindfulness is the mental factor, the tool to hold, which will help us to cultivate concentration.
Attention? Like attention?
What?
Mindfulness, like attention?
Attention. The word attention is used a little bit differently in Buddhism. That's another mental factor, but it's used a little bit differently than mindfulness. Okay, let's have a look at these nine stages. Stage one, down the bottom here, the elephant is the mind. The fact that it's black is symbolizing dullness. The monkey is symbolizing conceptual thought in general. The fact that it's black is symbolizing this excitement. So what we see at stage one is that the elephant and monkey are running wildly ahead of the meditator. So stage one, called setting the mind, what we notice is that our mind is completely out of control. And this is the first stage of practice. And often what happens here, of course, is we come into this practice with completely unrealistic expectations. And often we come into this practice thinking, my mind's not too bad. You know, I have a little bit of dullness and distraction, but I think I should be able to focus on the breath without too much difficulty. And of course, when we sit down and we start to focus on the breath, and then of course, usually what happens within 3 seconds, we're completely distracted. And often we're distracted for a long period of time, maybe many minutes. And then suddenly we realize, hang on, I'm supposed to be on the breath. We come back to the breath for another 3 seconds, and then we're gone again. And then, of course, when that happens, then often people go, I can't meditate. I just can't meditate. In fact, it's worse than that. Since I've started meditating, my mind has got worse. Because before it used to be sort of okay, but now it's completely out of control. So I'm definitely doing something wrong. And it's even worse than that, because then people open their eyes and look around. Everyone else is super still. I'm the only one who can't meditate in this world. And then we become completely depressed. And think we're hopeless. You know, I'm the only one who can't meditate. Most people are having this experience. And you can meditate. In fact, this is the very first sign of progress, is simply to see how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. Up until the point where we started meditating, our mind is always being outward. We're not really aware how crazy and chaotic our mind really is. It's only when we have to try to focus on a single object do we realize how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. So this is actually the first sign of progress, to see how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. So reaching stage one is simply noticing that. We can just hold the object for 1 or 2 seconds, noticing how chaotic our mind is. We've got to step one, good work, making progress. Then if we continue our practice, we'll get around the corner to stage two, which is called continuous setting. And what we notice here is that the elephant and monkey are not running so fast anymore, and they have a little bit of white on the top of their head, and that white is symbolizing a little bit of stability and clarity. So what we're noticing by stage two of the practice, we're noticing now that certain times in our meditation, our mind is starting to settle down a little bit, and that maybe we can hold the object up to a minute or two, but still we're distracted often for long periods of time. But we do notice from time to time our mind is settling down a little bit. That's stage two. Then if we go around the corner to stage three, this is called resetting, and here we notice a couple of things. One, we notice now that the rope of mindfulness is tied to the elephant of the mind, meaning now our mindfulness is getting a lot better. So much so, by stage three, we can now focus on the object longer. Maybe we can focus on the object 5 or 10 minutes before we get distracted. And now when we get distracted, we quickly recognize that and quickly come back. And that's symbolized by the elephant turning the head backwards, meaning we quickly come back from distractions. Now we see the rabbit has come into the picture, the rabbit on the back of the elephant. The rabbit is symbolizing subtle dullness. Because by stage three now, we can hold the object a lot better, and if we get distracted, we quickly come back. So we may think, I'm getting close to shamatha, because I don't lose it, and when I do, I'm quickly back. But we've still got a long way to go, because the quality of our attention still needs a lot of work. We have hardly begun to develop any clarity. And so what we need to recognize here is this subtle dullness. We need to recognize that our mind is not very sharp or clear. If we don't pick up that now, we'll get stuck here. Of course, subtle dullness existed from the beginning, but at stage one and two, we had much more heavy problems to worry about than a little bit of subtle dullness. But by stage three onwards, now subtle dullness starts to become a bit of a problem, and we need to pick it up and sharpen the focus. If we go to stage four, called close setting, now by stage four, mindfulness is getting a lot better. We can hold the object the entire session without ever losing it. But still, we have a lot of work to do on the quality of our attention. You may have noticed already that we can focus on the breath and seem like we can think about breakfast at the same time. So that's sort of like background static and noise that's interfering with the quality of our attention. So we're slowly trying to reduce and eliminate that background static. And that's a lot what we're doing over stage five and six. Over stage five and six, we see the meditator now with the hook of introspection. Now we are fine-tuning our focus. And here, the analogy often given is the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Likewise, if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. So we are fine-tuning our focus here. If it's too tight, we relax. If it's too loose, we sharpen our focus. We're constantly fine-tuning our focus, starting to overcome more and more subtle levels of agitation and dullness. And then when we get round to stage 7 and 8, what we see there is the rabbit is gone, we're saying goodbye to the monkey, there's hardly any black left on the elephant. Now by stage 7 and 8, we can, with a little bit of effort, we can start the meditation and then it really becomes very spontaneous, and we can meditate the whole session without any hint of subtle dullness or agitation. And then if we get to stage 9, we're in the cave, now it becomes completely spontaneous, that we can, in a very spontaneous way, without effort, we can focus on the object for extended period of time without any hint of agitation or dullness whatsoever. But we still haven't got to shamatha. And to describe the process here, I'd like to again read from Alan Wallace. He describes very clearly how we actually transition from stage 9 to shamatha. And shamatha is the diagram in the middle at the top, where we have the meditator flying through the sky and riding on the elephant of the mind. So let's see what he says about how we make this transition. Following the realization of the 9th stage of attentional balance, you are now primed to achieve shamatha. The 9 preceding stages entail many incremental changes, but the actual accomplishment of shamatha involves a radical transition in your body and mind. You will be like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. This shift is characterized by specific experiences that take place within a discrete, relatively brief period of time. According to accounts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, the first sign of the achievement of shamatha is the experience of a sense of heaviness and numbness on the top of the head. This allegedly happens to anyone who experiences this transition, regardless of the specific method followed. It is said to feel as if a palm were being placed on the top of your head. It is not unpleasant or harmful, just unusual. Something remarkable must be taking place in the cortical region of your brain at this point, but so far, no one has monitored the brain correlates of this shift using magnetic resonance imaging or an electroencephalograph. This physical sensation on the top of the head is symptomatic of a shift in your nervous system or network of vital energies that is correlated with gaining freedom from mental dysfunction, a general state of mental imbalance characterized by stiffness, rigidity, and unwieldiness. Consequently, you achieve a state of mental pliancy in which your mind is fit and supple like never before. From a contemplative perspective, when the mind is dysfunctional, it is prone to laxity and excitation. It is hard to generate enthusiasm for healing the afflictions of your mind or for devoting yourself to virtuous mental activity. Once you are free of such mental dysfunction, you can focus your mind without resistance on any meaningful object or task. And such a mind is now set to be fit or serviceable. This is the key to achieving optimum mental performance. So this mental pliancy is symbolized by the meditator riding on the elephant of the mind, meaning now we can direct our mind to whatever we want without any resistance whatsoever. Following this sense of pressure on the top of your head, you experience the movement of vital energies moving in your body. And when they have coursed everywhere throughout your body, you feel as if you are filled with the power of this dynamic energy. You are now freed of physical dysfunction, so your body feels buoyant and light like never before. So that's symbolized by the meditator flying through the sky. When we achieve shamatha, it's said that our body feels light like cotton. Both your body and mind are now imbued with an exceptional degree of pliancy, which makes them remarkably fit for engaging in all kinds of mental training and other meaningful activities. When physical pliancy initially arises, the vital energies catalyze an extraordinary sense of physical bliss, which then triggers an equally exceptional experience of mental bliss. This rush of physical and mental rapture is transient, which is a good thing, for it so captivates the attention you can do little else except enjoy it. Gradually it subsides and you are freed from the turbulence caused by this intense joy. Your attention settles down in perfect stability and clarity. You have now achieved shamatha. Sounds pretty good. Any questions? This book I'm reading from now is called Attention Revolution, and it's the book I recommend for shamatha practice. It's from Alan Wallace, and he talks about, in fact, these three practices: using the breath, the mind, and the awareness of awareness. And he talks about how to progress through these nine stages. And of course, this is in your book list in the back of your red booklet, this name of the book. So I can really recommend this. A very good book for shamatha practice. Any other questions? Yeah.
For us modern life people, how realistic is it to progress to some of these stages, and how much effort do we need to put in? Do we need a 1 year retreat or?
Yeah. Sometimes in the Tibetan manuals, you'll see things like, if you're someone of dull faculties, 9 months. Medium faculty, 6 months. Sharp faculty, 3 months. That's what often you'll see, something like that. But personally, I think it's a little bit over-optimistic for our modern society. Because remember, we're starting from a very different point than people living in those societies, much more calm to begin with. What Alan Wallace says in his book is that studies show that in any field of expertise, to become proficient in any field of expertise across the border, across the anyone, studies show you need 5,000 to 10,000 hours of practice to become expert in any field. Music, some technical field, anything, you need 5,000 to 10,000 hours of practice. So he's suggesting maybe it's something like that here. Then people go, well, that's impossible with my lifestyle, so I won't bother. I think this would be a big mistake. Because even if whatever effort we can put in, if we can make some progress to stage even 2 or 3, we're going to notice some improvement in our attention skills. And we're already going to start to benefit. So, therefore, if whatever our conditions allow, if whatever effort we put into this, we'll get the benefit. And, of course, the more benefit we get, maybe you'll find better and better conditions and more time to enter into this sort of practice. But, of course, if we really want to go a long way in this practice, then, yes, probably we're going to need to do some retreats rather than just doing, you know, a little bit of meditation each day.
Once we reach one stage, we can't fall back, or do we?
The analogy I use is we go to the gym to get fit. Okay. So we do some fitness work. We reach a certain level of fitness. If we stop going to the gym, what happens? Okay. Same here. If we stop, slowly we go back. But like the gym, often initially we need to put a lot of effort to make some level. But then to maintain that level, we just need to have some little bit less to maintain the level. If we want to go more, then of course more. But to maintain, we can maintain it with a minimum level of exercise. Similarly here, if we reach a certain level, we can maintain that. But of course, if we want to go further, then of course we need to put more effort.
Is there something like muscle memory in your...
Yeah, sometimes people use that analogy that you need to exercise the muscle of mindfulness. Sometimes people use that analogy. One thing is, what does it mean to be at a particular stage? For example, stage 3 was we can focus on the object, usually 5 or 10 minutes. If we get distracted, we quickly come back. To be at stage 3 means that's our normal experience. Now, in a particular meditation, we may have that experience. But that doesn't mean we're at stage three. So if that's our average experience, that's what it means to be at stage three. Sometimes better, sometimes not so good. But on average, that's our experience, then we're at stage three. So your question is? Yeah, probably because we didn't lose it back to the level of the beginning.
Because it's outside of memory. Like, I just wanted to ask whether there's something.
Oh, that, I don't know. I don't know.
Something similar, like
I don't know. I don't know. I'd just be speculating. I don't know.
That's the concept of reincarnation, no? That they say that people that find it very easy to understand these stuff, to meditate, is because they have some subtle or, I don't know, unconscious memory of something they did.
No, no, that's because they still have the imprints.
So that would be maybe muscle memory?
Not really. I mean, I think she's talking about losing the thing. We're talking here about, what I'm talking about is that whatever actions we do in this life has imprints. And it's like habits. And that habit stays with us. So maybe I think this is a little bit different to that. Maybe. I'm not sure. Okay, last question. Maybe who was... Yeah, okay.
Do you think that if I concentrate... Because my object and my work, let's say translating or editing or writing a book, would that also be kind of...
So... And this is an important point that I'm going to emphasize on the last morning of the course, practice. Sometimes, you know, people following spiritual path, talking amongst themselves, and one will say to the other, when do you do your practice? Oh, I do it every morning at 6:30 for an hour or half an hour. If this is our idea of practice, we're not going to go anywhere. Practice is meditation plus integrating in daily life. So here with shamatha, mindfulness, means meditating, strengthening the muscle of mindfulness, and then in daily life, integrating. So therefore, in daily life, we apply the mindfulness and we keep cultivating mindfulness in daily life. So these sorts of activities, if we do them with mindfulness, very helpful and necessary. And if we do these two things together, best. The best. Okay. Let's stop there. We've run out of time. So that then completes the teaching part of this course. The meditations for today with Renato, I think he's going to do in the next session a little bit meditation on refuge, particularly looking a little bit maybe at what sort of things we go for refuge now and see whether they're useful or not. And then this evening, you're going to get introduced to this Tonglen practice that I talked about earlier. And we're going to also practice the Tonglen one or two more times in the coming days as well, because it's one of the main compassion practices that are widely practiced in Tibetan Buddhism. So it's a very powerful practice, so we'll do that a couple of times in the coming days, but first this evening with Renato. So then the next 2 days are meditation days. So no teaching, no discussion groups. So the morning meditation before breakfast, you'll continue the shamatha practice with Renato, moving into mind and more the awareness of awareness practice. And then, of course, the evening session also with Renato. And then the morning between breakfast and lunch, there'll be 3 meditation sessions, I think 9, 10 and 11, 15. I'll be guiding and leading those. And then 3 meditation sessions in the afternoon, 2, 4, and 5:30, and Renato will be guiding those. So this is the same program for the next 2 days. So what I can really recommend for the next 2 days is to maintain the silence, because there's really no need to talk in the next 2 days because there's no discussion group, no class. So if we really maintain the silence well, I think you're going to get the most out of these meditation sessions. And really, if we can maintain the silence for those 2-day period, often what happens is that we start to really get to know ourselves much better, and we can even start to even have some insight into our life. But if we start talking, we'll dissipate that, and of course then we'll spoil the experience or practice for the people around us. So I really recommend stay nice and silent, and you'll get the most out of it. So that's the program for the next 2 days. Any last question about that before we stop? Which Vipassana practice? Yeah, we'll be doing a mixture of meditations, the shamatha in the morning, and then the analytical meditations I and Renata will be leading. So there will be a few Vipassana practices there, a few other types of analytical meditations as well. So we're going to have a mix. We're sort of picking the main ones, the ones that are very important. So yes, there will be some Vipassana, and I promised, I think, to do a little bit of Vipassana in terms of the nature of the mind, which is not so much the focus in this Lam Rim, but I think it's can be very helpful. So I want to at least do one meditation, maybe two, looking at that Vipassana practice of the nature of the mind and see what we get from that. You mean all meditations? The general recommendation is to have them slightly open in general. For certain meditations, such as the shamatha practice, observing the mind and resting in awareness, is very much encouraged. And I think for all the rest, we do what works for us. If we're sort of very agitated person, probably better to have them closed. If we're dull, probably better to have them at least slightly open.
And if we change it, like in the morning, for me it's better open, and it's easier
to close. No, it's okay. Okay. Let's leave it there. Have a break. Renata, I'll see you at 5:30. I'll see you tomorrow morning.